Kia ora te whānau. Ah, we're here. We're finally here recording the first episode of Stillness Speaks. And in this episode, I'm just going to share my story because what I found is when I would share my story, I would kind of move back and forth around, you know, the things that I picked up or healing modalities or spaces. And yeah, I just really wanted to start this whole thing with my story so that you have some type of understanding of how I moved forward, eh? Oh, I'm breathing for myself here. Fuck, my heart's racing. And I'm not sure why. And it's funny, before this podcast, I was listening to a podcast around fear, but more so around business and like the choices that we make. And sometimes we can try and eliminate the fear in order to take action. Whereas I'm learning, it's through the fear that we learn something, you know, regardless of the outcome. And so I'm sitting here, kids are at school, I've got my cup of tea ready, and what's been interesting is the moment that I committed to this, I feel like anything, you know, the moment that you plant a seed or you open yourself up to something, it then, you know, universe or God gives you beautiful opportunities, people, environments for you to connect with, which waters that seed. And so, yeah, the moment I committed to this, I've been having really interesting, beautiful conversations with Wahine, even my husband, around sexual trauma. And yeah, it's just reminded me how important this conversation is. You know, I've shared before that I've been talking about this for quite some time, like a few years now, and pulled away from it and then come back to it and then pulled away from it. And it feels grounding. Does that even make sense? I feel grounded sharing about it again from the place, or, you know, the place that I'm in now. And when I mean by now, not so much circumstances or the environment, but more so how I feel about myself, how I feel within my body. All right, I feel like I'm just talking caca. So we're going to get into the story. But before I begin, if this is the first episode you're listening to, if you don't mind, and this is an invitation, just go back and listen to the previous episode where it says start here. I speak into like just grounding, how to look after yourself, or making sure that you're looking after yourself, being intentional when you're listening to the series, because that's what I want. I want Wahine or even Tane, men, to receive these episodes with intention, not just for the sake of filling themselves up with more information or, you know, filling themselves up with someone else's story. Okay, 3 minutes. Come on, Vanessa. All right. So I grew up in a beautiful place, paradise, called Otara, in South Auckland, in New Zealand. And the kind of family dynamic, and I like to paint this picture, is we lived in the back house in like a granny flat, my mum and I. So my parents had separated after I was born. And so, yeah, we lived in the back house, just me and my mum. And in the front house was my auntie. And my auntie whangaed like so many kids, not even funny. She had a whole bunch of kids in the front house. And then in the garage next door was a cousin. Honestly, the garage was like the one-stop shop for anyone who needed a place to stay. Like, even my mum and I, we lived in the garage before she built a little granny flat out the back. And then to the left-hand side was my grandmother and my grandfather. Well, she had remarried. And even to the back of the house on another property were, they weren't cousins, but they were local friends, or we felt like they were cousins. And so, you know, you imagine that there was probably, I've counted, I think 15 of us kids that would play all the time. You know, like there was enough of us to play touch. There was enough of us to play tiggy. There was enough for, you know, some to go play at the park and then for some to go to the shop and get dinner. There was always someone to hang out with. And when I say this, it's no like disrespect to my whānau, my family whatsoever, but there was a lack. A lack of adult supervision because they were busy people. You know, my auntie was looking after the marae. My mom was a single mom working a couple of jobs. Yeah, so we were just kind of left to our own devices, which was fun, bro. Like some of my most favorite memories are just hanging out with my cousins. And So it's hard for me to pinpoint a particular age when I first experienced sexual trauma, but it's between the age of like 5 and 7. So I was in primary school, and it was from a cousin of mine who was female. And I'm not going to go like give names and all that sort of thing because I don't think it matters. Like for me, it doesn't matter. And I'm not going to go into too much detail as well because for me, that doesn't matter. And I don't remember the first experience, but it's almost like a whole long string of memories that, oh, it happened here and it happened here and it happened here. And every time that I remember that it would happen, there was no one around. You know, there were no adults around, and it would happen in various places. So different rooms. And remember how I was saying there were 4 different houses? It would happen in the garage, in the main house, and then also in our granny flat as well. And there was also a caravan, and I remember an experience of sexual trauma there. And I was reflecting today, it's quite interesting. I was never, from what I remember, I was never told, don't say anything. You know, I was never told, like, you can't say anything that this has happened. And so I don't remember being told, like, be silenced. It was just something, I felt silenced, you know. And because it's a cousin, we'd had this relationship, there's so many of us, it didn't feel like I was being, like, used or mistrust. Is that the word? Yeah, I didn't feel like I was being, like, fucked over. Because honestly, what I was told, and I think most of my cousins were told, is be careful of the stranger. Be careful of the man down the road. My mum had this, like, if a random person pulls up in a white van, you know, the typical, like, pedo talk. If someone turns up with a white van, ask them what the, like, the password is. And our little password was lolly. So if someone random was to come, I just have to go, what's the password? And if they couldn't figure out the password, then my mum would say, then you run and you ask for help. And so it was instilled in my mind that danger is from outside your family unit, outside the whānau. And so as I'm experiencing, you know, everything that I had experienced as a child, and especially by a female, you know, no one really warns you about that. And she was in her teens at the time. No one really warns you. No one says to a young girl, watch out for an auntie or watch out for your cousin. It's always watch out for the bad man. You know, everything was like put on to the man. And so everything I'd be taught, everything I experienced didn't quite make sense. And so I never told anyone. I didn't tell anyone, and I didn't tell my mum until I was in my 20s. So although I didn't tell anyone, or in my mind I didn't think anything was wrong, if I was to look back and reflect and sit with these memories, my body knew something was wrong. Like my body knew, because I would constantly move into a state of freeze. My body would be frozen, and I was just like paralyzed, like absolutely paralyzed. And I'd tell myself like, oh, fuck, it's happening again. It's happening again. Oh, I have to do this now. Or I have to do that. And I don't want to do it. But if I don't do this thing, then I don't know what's going to happen. And I just want it to be over. And so that's why I would put myself or constantly do the things that I was told to do in order just to get it over. I just wanted it over, and then I could just get on with my life. At some point, it had become my normal, where it became a routine, and it's not something that I ever questioned. I was like, oh, here we are again, you know, not in that tone, but if I was to look back, so, okay, so we're here now, and then these are the motions of what we need to do and what I need to do, and then once it's finished, and then this is what happens, and then I don't tell anybody, and then I go about my life. It was ingrained in me that this was part of life, like this had become my normal. And what was interesting is, so because my parents were separated, my dad had remarried, I would go to their house on the weekend. So typical Monday to Friday, I'd be with my mum, and then my dad would pick me up from his job Friday night, and then I'd stay till Sunday. And during that time, I used to love going to my dad's house, not because they lived in, you know, a beautiful suburb and a beautiful home, and I was the only child, so, you know, got massive attention, like cool as. It was because I felt really safe, you know, and if I was to, like, speak about my nervous system, I was completely relaxed, like completely relaxed. I would have the most amazing sleeps. I'd have beautiful conversations with my family, you know, my stepmom and my dad. And I remember, like, he would put me to bed every night. My dad would put me to bed. I'd lie down. My dad would sing. My dad's passed now, but my dad would sing the same song over and over, like fee, fi, fo, fum, something, something, something. And then he would give me a kiss and a hug and tuck me into bed. Even in my teens, my dad would still tuck me into bed. And then he'd turn the light off and then he would leave. And I remember when he would come in and give me a kiss and a hug, my whole body would recoil. I was like, oh, don't touch me, don't kiss me. But it's not because it was my dad. Like, my dad wasn't the problem. It wasn't his fault. It's because I was experiencing the sexual trauma. And anytime someone would come near me or touch me, I didn't know how to respond. You know, it just left my being feeling really yucky and gross and dirty. And so this went on for a few years, and I'd made my way up north. You know, my family and I would travel up to Powaringa from a beautiful place called Powaringa, and we'd spend our school holidays up there, Christmas. And yeah, we traveled up there, and we have a couple of shacks that are on our property. So we have the main house and a couple of shacks, and because we're cousins and cousins hang out together, the adults were in the house doing their thing, we all then slept in the sleep out. And so there's mattresses all over the floor. I would say there was five or six of us in that little, it's like a little hut, a little shack, you know, you can fit like five mattresses and there's the door and that's about it, and a little cupboard. And this was another cousin of mine. So I was going to sleep, you know, it was bedtime. He was behind me, so this is a male cousin now. He was behind me, and then I could feel his arm like coming over. And because, you know, I'm in a state of remembering, I was like, oh, I know this feeling. I know what's happening, but why is it with a different person? Like, this doesn't feel right. And so I moved again into a state of freeze. It really does feel like I'm paralyzed, even though the mind's racing and I know what I should be doing or what I could be doing, my whole body's paralyzed. And at some point, I just moved my body and did like a big yawn as if I was waking up, and then his hand pulled away. And that's when I went inside. Like, that's probably the first time, even though it was with another person, that I had responded in that way rather than just lying there and pretending like nothing happened. I went inside to the main house. My auntie was in the room, and I don't know what I said, if I said I was scared or something like that, but I just remember crying very quietly underneath a blanket, and then just fell asleep. And so, yeah, for me, that was like I had done something, but I also didn't know what else to do with that information. Like, how do you go to an adult as a child and explain what's happened while also holding the secret or something I've experienced for so many years with somebody else? And it was the next day, the sun had risen, and there's a weed, I'm pretty sure it's called mangroves, that are all on our land. And I'd had a machete, and from memory, it's the first time I felt anger, like absolute anger and hatred. And because I felt like I couldn't tell anybody, that's where, you know, you could call it channeling. That's where I channeled my anger, was like smashing into these weeds and into these mangroves. In Powaringa, bro, there's no reception here. There's no Wi-Fi. And this was a long time ago. I think I must have been 12 because I just started high school. Yeah, like 11 or 12, I started high school quite early. And mum said that she was going into Kaitaia. Kaitaia is a small town, maybe 25 minutes, 30 minutes away. And so I had the old school Alcatel. You know when you finally get a bar and it's like, I had one of those. And part of me was like, I'm going to tell somebody, but I'm not going to tell an adult. I'm going to tell my best friend. And so I remember driving in the car so clearly, staring at my phone, waiting for these bars to come up. My messages were coming through just from friends. And that's when I had messaged my best friend and said, to be honest, I don't exactly remember what I said, but something had happened. And do you imagine as like a 12, 13-year-old receiving this kind of a message? Like, I would never know like what to do with that kind of information. And thankfully, she had told her mum what had happened. At the time, I was really angry. I was bitter. You know, how dare you break my trust? How dare you tell someone? This was between me and you. Like, bro, that's fucking inhumane to put that kind of pressure on someone. But at the time, you know, like you'd finally opened up and then you told someone. Eventually, we made our way down to Auckland. So again, nobody knew what was happening. Made our way back down to Auckland and I stayed at my friend's house. I'm pretty sure I was picked up. Anyway, I remember sitting at my friend's house and that's when her beautiful mom sat down and spoke to me about, like, this is wrong. And these are this is how I would phrase it. These are the actions that we can take. Well, this is what we can do. And the first one was, would you like to go to the police and make a statement? And I remember the police station wasn't open at the time because it was late at night. And then she just kept saying to me, like, you need to tell your mum, you know, like, you need to tell your mum and I'll be here with you. Like, we'll come and support you. And I'm pretty sure it was the next day. And we'd finally gotten home, back to Otara. And again, I don't want to say names, so I'll just say my best friend's mum was there, my best friend, my auntie, my mother, and my grandmother. And we were all sitting in our lounge room in the back house. And I could just feel like tension. I could feel the unease. I could feel the discomfort in the air. And I'm someone who, yeah, I feel what people are feeling. You can almost smell when something is going down. And I just knew that it wasn't going to be good. Even though I was told that this is the right thing to do, it still felt incredibly uncomfortable. And I don't remember if I said something or if my best friend's mum had said what had happened. But what I do remember is my mother went into shock. Like the look on her face, I will never forget. She went into shock. And I would say I could feel her anger, but that's something for her to describe. But I could feel her anger. And my best friend's mum put her hand on my mum's shoulder. And yeah, my mum was like, don't. Like, do not touch me. And looking over at my auntie and my grandmother, you could just see the sadness, like the real, I can't believe this has happened. And again, I'm a child, so I don't know what's happened in my family previously. This felt like something new for me, like, oh, shit, I've like unleashed something that nobody knows about, or maybe I'm the first, or, yeah, it just felt new to me. I eventually stayed again at my best friend's house, I think for a couple of days, and in that time, I don't know what happened. I actually don't know what happened at home while I was away. Mum never told me. And I see that as a way, you know, she was there to protect me. Mum took me to a police station. It wasn't a police station, but a place that you could make statements. And that's where I made a police statement the first time. So, you know, I'm 12 years old, surrounded by these police. They're asking all these kinds of questions. And what was, I use the word interesting because it's interesting now, is I was giving over information about one incident while also holding, and I've said this before, while also holding the secret of everything that had happened for so many years. So, yeah, internally it was conflicting. Like, oh, well, why am I talking about this person but not this person? But everyone's angry at this person, but they don't know about this person. So, yeah, it's just interesting. You feel like you're doing the right thing. You're told it's the right thing to do, yet internally, but I was fucked. I was so confused. And one thing that I'll always forever be grateful for is my mother put me straight into counselling. And it was a little place in Manukau. I don't remember going for too long because not long after we moved to Australia, but I did get some counselling. Did it serve a purpose? Yes. I didn't really learn any tools, but it was an opportunity for me to go to some place every single week for an hour and just talk, you know. I wouldn't say I felt safe, completely safe, but just the opportunity to speak and knowing that this lady wasn't going to talk about anything to anybody, it was between me and her, that felt really good. But, you know, I grew up in a very, I wouldn't call it Māori space, but the way we did things and, you know, I went to Kura Kaupapa. We grew up on the marae. My auntie or my family ran the Whaiora marae, which was just up the road. The way that we did things was very, you could call it indigenous, you know. And then all of a sudden I'm in this room. There's a lady with a piece of paper on a clipboard and a pen and asking really direct questions, and there's no rapport being built. I was like, I don't know, lady, but I see where we're going with this. And then not long after that, I'd have to ask my mum, but I would say it was probably around 5 months. Mum had decided to sell everything, sell her home, leave her job, pack up everything, and then we had moved to Australia, Sydney, Australia. One thing I've been reflecting on is it's not my fault. And I remember hearing that in counselling, but when I look back and I think, oh, it's not my fault, I don't think of the sexual abuse or the sexual trauma. Where I had blamed myself was when I'd finally told my mum and my auntie and my grandmother, is feeling their anger, their sadness. That's what felt like was my fault. I was like, oh, I've made you sad. I've made you angry. I've made you upset. What's happened to me has now put you into a state of shock. That's where I first noticed blame. There was another incident that had happened with just a random man on the bus. So again, I've already experienced what I experienced with two people over a long period of time. This had already come out. I was on not a school bus, just a public bus coming home from school. And yeah, I'd sat next to this old fella, just an old man on the bus, and I would say 5 minutes into it, he'd started just kind of shifted his hand over, and I could feel his fingers kind of moving around just on my leg. And yeah, it was interesting to see how I would respond with the first person, which was a state of freeze, and then fawn, I would say fawn as well. And then the second person was fight. Flight. And then the same thing with this random man on the bus. And so the moment I pushed the button to get off the bus, I was half an hour away from home. He immediately pulled his hand away, you know. So it's interesting for me to reflect back. Was I making shit up? Or was it me? Or was it all in my head? But I distinctively remember the moment I pushed that button, he quickly pulled his hand away. And you know, this man touching my leg wasn't a massive deal, but I'm not saying that that's right too. But it just fucking re-triggered everything for me. So I got off the bus, rang my mum straight away, told her what had happened. And my mum being who she is, she's a hearty fucking woman. She's down for justice. Don't let anything come, you know, between, nothing is to hurt my baby. We went straight to the bus depot, which was all the way in Papakura, which was probably about a good 40-minute drive. We spoke to the bus depot people. Asked who the driver was, do they have any cameras, do they know if they, you know, like what the man looked like, all this sort of stuff. Nothing came from it. But a lesson that I learned in that was like, don't be afraid to chase, we could call it justice. You know, if something's happened and you feel hard, not hard done by, but something's wrong, bro, I was a fucking teenager, you know, no man should be doing that, no old fella should be doing that. Don't be afraid. Like, there's nothing to be ashamed about doing what you feel is right for you. And I remember mum saying, like, I'm not only just worried about my daughter. What if he does this to somebody else? So nothing came from that. But in that was a really good lesson for me. So we decided to, I shouldn't say we, mum decided that we moved to Australia. But I remember mum saying, quite a lot, you know, like, oh, do you want to move to Australia? Do you want to move to Australia? I'm like, no. Like, I was a teenager, bro. I got all my friends. I loved the community that I lived in. Like, I loved my family. And then once this had happened and it all came out, I just felt the discomfort. Like, there was a giant disconnect between myself and my cousins. And I feel like the disconnect still comes from, not now, but back then, was the silence or the discomfort. Like, how the fuck do we even navigate something like this, you know? We didn't talk about trauma back then. No one had fucking Instagram pages or Facebook pages you could go to. I was the only person getting counseling, which was like a really short time. This was a real new concept. I shouldn't say concept, like trauma or experience to deal with, especially when no one talks about this shit, eh? And I had a little going away party. You know, everyone was drunk. And there was There was an incident that had happened between me and one of my close cousins. You know, he was my best friend, man. And he'd had a few drinks and we were all sort of out on the front, the main road. And I remember him looking at me and he was like, "This is your fault. You asked for it. You asked for it." And that sentence stuck with me for so many fucking years. "You asked for it." And I was like, so even though I fought with him, you know, like fought, like, "Fuck you, not my fault, da 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 da," it still stuck with me. I was like, oh, maybe I did want it. Oh, maybe I asked for it. Oh, fuck, maybe it is my fault. Okay. And so unconsciously, these new beliefs or new thoughts start to hardwire and it becomes my way of being. Oh, I'm asking for it. Okay, well, if I'm asking for it, then all I need to do is A, B, and C, and then I can get what I want. And that created a lot of friction between myself and my cousin at the time. And it's not something we'd ever spoken about. It's just silence. You're like, well, fuck you. Now we're not going to speak again and I'm going to move to Australia. But it's really interesting how an experience like that, that hasn't anything to do with the experience of sexual trauma, but something outside of that, can stick with me and almost hurt me more, or, yeah, fucking feel more traumatizing than the sexual trauma itself. And I'm not saying that that'll be true for you, but that was my truth, you know, at the time, and something that I had to really, really sit with. So my whole family had come to the airport to say goodbye. Whole family was there, you know, haka, waiata, the whole thing. And the second cousin that I experienced sexual abuse from had asked me to come and have a conversation downstairs. I was, I think I was 13 at the time. And he apologized. He apologized. He said, "I'm sorry." I don't remember exactly, but I just remember him like being remorseful and the look on his face, and just to hear the words "I'm sorry," and then we hugged, and that was the end of that. And that was a really healing moment for me, where I didn't blame him for anything. I was like, okay, cool, we've had this conversation, it's been aired out, I can see you've acknowledged it. This is me putting words into a 13-year-old, you know, like, fuck, as if I was thinking like that. But if I was to look back, like, just to be acknowledged, to know that, fuck, I wasn't lying, because I'm telling you now, the look on people's faces within my family is like, for sure this bitch is lying. And it didn't need to go anywhere further than that. I didn't need to go around and say, oh, he apologized, or see, it was true. Just between him and I, eye to eye, I'm sorry, hug it out. And then, you know, the rest was for me to deal with. Yeah, that was really healing for me while still holding the secret of the first cousin that I experienced it from. I just wanted to take a moment to speak into how I best remember how I was behaving. So I'm really good at wearing 25 different masks. It's almost like nobody knew how I was feeling, what was happening in my world. I was just really good at masking everything. I could put on the pretty face. I could put on the pretty clothes. I could laugh. I could make jokes. I could be helpful. I could be quiet. Like whatever you need me to be, I will be that person. And so, yeah, it was just really easy for me to hide, to really hide what was happening up until that moment that it had come out that I told my mom. I don't remember being, like depressed or anxious or sad. Like even though I'd experienced sexual trauma from two cousins, we would still hang out. We would still play. We would still sleep under the same roof. We would still go on family trips, like when we'd go up north. Everything was still normal. So even though I was experiencing something on the side, I'd then put on my other mask and be like, no, all right, and time to get on with life. And then, oh, fuck, it's happening again. And then time to get on, you know, to get on with life. It wasn't until I think I'd started hitting my teens, maybe even around 11 years old, because I went to Kura Kaupapa, which is a total immersion for Māori, so we only spoke Māori at that school. I started to lose disconnection from culture and especially the language. So mum had told me that I could speak fluent up until a certain age, and then she just said, and then you just stopped all of a sudden. And I remember speaking about this on social media at one point, sharing the story, and a lady had responded that when, not all, but when someone experiences sexual trauma, one of the things that can affect them is their language. And so it's interesting that I could speak two languages and then one was lost. Not lost, but silenced in some way. And then having to move to Australia, like I was submerged in this kind of world and then disconnected from my family, disconnected from my friends, disconnected from my culture. But that had to happen. You know, that's something that I had to learn down the line, is that had to happen in order for me to be safe. Because I was quite bitter about it. I was like, well, if we didn't move to Australia, then I would still be doing this. And if we didn't move to Australia, then I would still have these friends and this experience. But from my mother's perspective, safety always comes first. Like, fuck everything else. Safety needs to come first. And I found, as I started to get older and hear other people's experiences, there was so much emphasis on how to keep the family together rather than how do we protect this child. And I really thank my mother for that, like for making that choice and that decision, that even though I felt like I lost something, I also gained. I gained a sense of safety. I gained a sense of self. I gained a sense of curiosity and self-exploration, because the place that we moved to, if you know Ōtara, love Ōtara, but we moved to Paddington, which was like gay, lesbian, central, cafes, bougie. It was a whole different place. So the culture shock, fuck me, was like next level. But I loved it. It was like a whole new start for me, where I didn't have to feel the tension. I didn't have to feel the discomfort. I didn't have to come face to face all the time with whatever everyone else was experiencing. I could just run away, which became a trait of mine for many years, was running, because I didn't know how to deal with shit, bro. How the fuck do you feel sadness? How do you feel anger? How do you feel disappointment? How do you feel betrayal? How do you feel self-responsibility? Like, fuck all that shit. I'm just going to run. And yeah, I ran for many years. I ran from myself. I ran from the experiences that I had. I ran from my family. I ran from my truth, my voice. I ran from my body. I was just in a constant state of not fight or flight, like survival. Everything was around survival for me. I wanted to start there and just share that beginning part, because like once I look back, I felt that most of my healing, because once I pulled away from an environment that felt so normal, I could then reflect. You know, you don't know unless you know. So that was my normal. And so I'd finally moved away and I was like, holy shit, like here's some perspective, Vanessa. That's where my healing really started, was once I moved to Australia. And so I just wanted to start there and share that part of my story. It feels good. It feels good to just kind of get it into one place. And even though I didn't go into detail, I just wanted to share. I really think it comes down to holding one secret while letting the other out, having such a close relationship with family while also feeling disconnected. The feeling of safety in one home and then going to my dad's place and then feeling safety. Responding to people that would love me and care for me, but rejecting them in some way because I didn't know how to respond because it made me feel really gross, even though it wasn't their fault. Before I finish up and close off this podcast, I just wanted to ask the question, and that is, how are you feeling as the receiver? How are you feeling in your body? Are you noticing any sensations? And just to remind yourself exactly where you are. So if I've taken you on a journey somewhere, or maybe your mind, your body has gone on a little journey, come back to the place that you're in. You know, feel the seat that you're sitting on or wherever you're standing. Look around, notice what you can see. Is it a piece of fruit? Is it a tree? Is it cat food? Is it a piece of art? Notice who's around you and just remind yourself where you are. Because I find once we start to consume or hear other people's stories, it takes us on a journey. But then we also forget to land back in our bodies, you know, because once you stop listening to this episode, you're going to have to go about your life, whatever that is, whether that's your mahi, back to your family, cleaning your house. Maybe you're a speaker getting up and speaking on stage. Maybe you're a shift worker and a night worker and you've got to go pack some packages. Maybe you're a youth worker, a teacher, a mother, whatever your role is in this world, you have to go about and do those things. And yeah, just inviting you to let some of that go. Remember where you are, come back to the present moment. So from here on in, I've written down a whole list of things, I want to talk about generational trauma, relationship to my body, sex and intimacy, because I feel like they have a whole episode within themselves. Counseling, different types of counseling that I engaged in, relationship to my family, not only like cousins, aunties and all that sort of thing, but my own family, like my kids and my husband. I've written down a few experiences that I had, like one of them is called the Clay Workshop to explore touch. I want to speak on sharing my story on social media and how that just kind of snowballed into its own thing. An experience I had speaking at our marae up north. Knowing my edge and what I was available for. Communication with my partner, birth, parenting and breastfeeding. Knowing my triggers, plant medicine, ikura, so my periods, ritual, women's circles, helping others without helping myself. Fuck me, that was a giant one for me. Books, resources, learning about the nervous system and regulating, rabbit holes and being the savior. That'll make sense once I record that episode. Trauma bonds, promiscuity, wanting to control. I've written down here a belief sharing causes pain. Oh, using it as a weapon. Because I like the response, like I was attached to the reaction and the validation. Stages of grief, embodiment, so many things. Oh my Lord, it just goes on and on and on. And you know, some of those episodes might bleed into each other, or you know, I might speak to a couple of those topics in one episode. All right, whānau, I'm going to leave it there. Look after yourself. Ground yourself. Eat something. If something has come up for you, talk to someone. Reach out to someone that you trust. Write it down. Move it out. Shake your body. go for a walk, whatever you need to do to just keep moving. Appreciate your ears. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your energy. And if you have anything, if you'd had anything that you'd like to share, questions, topics that you would like me to speak on, feel free just to email me or send me a DM on Instagram, and I'll leave links and all that sort of thing in the show notes. All right. Ka kite.